So welcome to Who Cares Presents Extraordinary Women. We've been travelling the world through these stories, at least metaphorically, Ecuador, Afghanistan, and for this episode and the following, because it's a two-parter, I'm going to share with you a journey that I literally took across the world, to Chile. I'd gone to Chile with the UNECE to speak at an event they'd convened looking at transparency in supply chains, and whilst I was there, I remembered the story of an indigenous woman I'd read about who'd been protesting lithium mining in the north of Chile. And this had really got my attention because the lithium industry is booming in large part because of environmentalism, because of the push towards renewables, electrification and batteries. And I really wanted to understand the voices of dissent and what issues the lithium boom might be causing. And so I took the opportunity to try and travel up to the Atacama Desert in the north of Chile and to meet with the indigenous lady. And in the process of trying to make contact with her, Sonia Ramos, and I'll share that interview next week, I came across another incredible woman, Cristina Dorador, and I can't wait to share this story with you. So I had the joy of traveling to the stunning Atacama Desert, sometimes called the Salar de Atacama. You'll hear Salar being mentioned a lot a few months ago. And I went to investigate the impact of lithium mining on the communities and on the ecosystems there, because I'm very conscious of the fact that the environmental movement is pushing for more lithium mining and wanted to understand why incredible, mostly women it seems, in those regions have been protesting the mining in those regions. I went because it felt like an important story to understand and to share, and I didn't know that it was actually going to be one of the most beautiful places I've ever experienced going to. The Atacama Desert is unbelievably beautiful. I mean, the sounds are incredible. Listen to these sound recordings as I walk across the crisp salt flats. And you can also hear the salt popping as the mountains kind of melt and in the heat of the desert. You can also hear my phone, ironically, charged with a lithium battery. And I was using my phone to connect with the different people that I was trying to meet on this trip. I met several different indigenous activists and leaders who have been resisting mining. And in our next episode, I'll share some of their voices with you. I visited a lithium mine. Saw the electric blue neon yellow imagery of a lithium mine in the region. And I also got to meet an incredible woman whose story I'm going to share with you in this episode. Her name is Cristina Dorador, and she's a scientist turned politician who is helping to rewrite Chile's constitution. Hi, Cristina. First of all, can you please introduce yourself to the Who Cares Wins listeners?
My name is Cristina Dorador. I am a scientist, microbial ecologist. I'm working at the University of Antofagasta in northern Chile. And currently I'm part of the Constitutional Assembly writing the new constitution for Chile.
Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me, Cristina. So the reason I wanted to come to Chile and visit the Atacama Desert is I'd seen the documentary that you made with Sonia Ramos, looking at the impact of lithium mining in the region. And I'm interested in listening to indigenous voices. And I'm also particularly interested because, as you know, lithium is a booming industry, largely because of the environmental movement pushing for decarbonization, pushing for electrification. And so it struck me as a kind of contradiction in the way that the environmental movement is creating potentially new environmental problems. I'd love to hear how you got to know Sonia, and how you got involved in that situation and what your observation is.
We're living difficult times. First, we need to advance and stop fossil fuels. But also at the same time, we have to start to think differently, because it's not just a replacement of materials. to stop fossil fuels and replace it with electric cars. Everything comes from somewhere, you know? We need materials, and the materials have an origin. And usually, this origin are all countries. So in the specific case of lithium, it's very complicated because in South America, lithium is in some specific ecosystem called salares. The salares are part of the old paleolakes that was covering almost all Atacama Desert. And through the time, they have been drying out and every time smaller because the evaporation rate are very high. So now we have those very isolated ecosystem, very unique in terms of biodiversity, and also of the adaptation that the life is have there because they are live under extreme conditions. So lithium is under the salt crust of these salares. Usually the industry is used to pump all this brine and also they have to destroy the surface of the salares to put the brines there and just leave them evaporate and concentrate to have a solution of lithium chloride. All this process sounds maybe not bad, but if we think in the context, we're talking about a process that evaporates a lot of water in the middle of the driest desert in the world. So that's also very contradictory. And also my feelings is that people that are the final user of these materials, for example, in the Northern Hemisphere, they really don't know where lithium comes from because in a society when everything is based on market and consume, people really don't ask where the things are come from. It's just, you can just buy it. So if we think about the replacement of fossil fuels to electric cars, it's not just to have in circulation 5 diesel cars and replace it for 5 electric cars.
Yeah, I think we also have to question our economic system. The ideas like circular economy is degrowth, things like that might help.
The problem as well is some complex problem needs also complex solutions. And for that, we need diversity. There's no other way. We need people that think differently, that come from the different origins, from different countries, indigenous people. And that's also where we're living now in the Constitutional Assembly for Chile. It's amazing to know different experiences. There is no just one way or one reason to see the world, and that includes economy. We live almost under a dogma of economy. And in countries like Chile, it's complicated. I think there's no just one solution, but we need to do something urgently because we're basically losing our planet, you know, at a very, very fast rate.
And what do you think about the fact that the lithium mining companies say that they're using very little fresh water, lithium mining in particular, that it's mostly salt water? And they would argue that there's no use for the salt water. As a scientist, do you think that's a strong enough environmental argument? Or do you think that the consequences of using the brine water, the salt water, is still very significant?
Well, when I start my scientific studies, I start working with lakes and rivers and also salares that are continental waters. So we have a concept of the basin. And everything at some point is related. So that's why we're talking about ecosystem. The water, independent if it's salty water or fresh water, the salts, the bacteria, the microinvertebrates, the animals, the flamingos, everything. So there is now robust scientific evidence showing that the lithium extraction is affecting the whole ecosystem. So to do this separation between, no, we're not extracting fresh water, is basically say that salt water isn't necessary. It's not important for the ecosystem, and it is important because it's part of it. We as a human are part of the ecosystem. We're not the owners. That's also putting in conflict some ideas of ecosystem services. That really the ecosystem produce services for us. The amount of extraction is so high that at the end, this fragile ecosystem, they don't have the resilience, you know, to really maintain it healthy under this big, big, big extraction.
What's your sense of mining in Chile? Would you rather stop it altogether? Do you think there's a way of managing it that can be more sympathetic to the environment? because it seems sort of inevitable it's going to grow as a sector and that Chile's kind of positioned to be a leader in the lithium boom. What's your advice on the constitution, for example? Which position do you take in terms of how Chile can best respond to the market demand for lithium?
Well, we have a lot of challenges in this field because historically Chile is a mining country. I mean, my family actually come from the mining history. Atacama Desert, where are located this big mining industry, is also a very important place, like from the geological point of view. They have a lot of reserves of certain minerals, but also they are very diverse minerals. So probably anything what you need, you can find in Atacama. And that's something, of course, very important for economy, but also is complicated for the environmental side. As a habitant of the desert, we have seen in the last year, especially in the last decade, how all the landscape have been modified. Sometimes when we travel through the desert, it's not possible to find certain mountains that have disappeared and replaced it by mine tailings, for example. So the amount of movement of material is immense, it's massive. So the big copper mining in the world is in my region, in Antofagasta, it's Escondida mine. You can see the hole from the space. The same happened with the lithium pools. Also, I wanted to say that the immensity of the extraction is something that we have to also take into account. It's not just that we have the materials, it's also the demand for that produce that there are more mining and also the expectation of the growth of these industries is increasing because especially for the demand of electric cars and zero carbon. So it's kind of contradictory because in the same region, at the same time, we have this mining that we are mentioned already, copper, lithium. And when we think about the people living in the region, is of course, it's one of the regions that produce more money for Chile, but also we are one of the have the lowest indicators of quality of life. If we really want to talk about sustainability, we need to have all this information, you know, in the table and to be very honest about the decision. And from the Constitution, we are trying to really push sustainability as well, ecology. We're talking about ecological constitution because it's the first country that's writing a new constitution under a climate crisis. So we need to think now, not only what's happening now, so what will happen in the next decades, because usually a constitution has to last for 50 years. So that's also the question I do sometimes. How will be Chile in the next 50 years if we still be the same, you know, exporting materials?
And are you optimistic about the new constitution? How has the process been working on it?
Yes, I'm optimistic because this was a process that actually was very difficult to have. Chile had a kind of rebellion in 2019 because of the, it was a social crisis, basically. The constitution that was written during the dictatorship put us in a very difficult situation. We have very few social rights. People finish their work and start, you know, to live on their pension, and they don't have social security, basically. It's very low. So that's why it was so strong. And one of the political solution was, okay, we will change the constitution. And the process was open. Those are why people like me, scientists, or a person like I don't have any political experience, are now thinking about what we need to do to change and to improve the life of Chileans. And we want to redistribute the power. And for example, Chile is a very centralist country. And what we approve already in the constitution is to create, so every region will be autonomic. And that's so important for democracy. And now we are fighting to have our own money. So we will not a federal country, but we are in the way to be more, you know, equal. And also now we are working in the social right, we are voting, we are discussing, that's sometimes are very intense sessions. People from the right are also very kind of opposite about the process. They are the one also that are owners of the big media. So the big newspaper in Chile, they're not very in favor of the new constitution. So yeah, First was the referendum if we want or not the new constitution. The option yes won for 80%. It was massive. And then start the process to choose the assemblies. And yeah, and I was elected by the highest majority in Antofagasta region. I don't know how.
And you're in the science group, right? And is that the first time that science has been put in a constitutional, I guess, body?
It's the first time. And the other day I mentioned that when the Human Rights Declaration was written, there was, a group of people writing it. And was a Chilean there, and a lawyer. And he's the one that proposed the right for science. So after 78 years, we are just putting in our constitution the right for science and knowledge.
Which other type of scientists are in the group?
The president of the assembly, she's a scientist as well, Maria Elisa Quinteros. She's a dentist and working in public health. And that's me, and there are other from the natural science, three, I think.
Are there any climate scientists?
No. I'm the closest one to that. When we start the process of the assembly, it was at the same time that was released one of the first IPCC reports. And I wrote a letter and was signed by most of the members of the assembly to invite Maisa Rojas, our current Minister of Environment. She's also an IPCC member of writing these reports, to give us a talk. Mm-hmm. And to tell us what's going on, because we thought that it's so important to start talking about climate change. Because and everyone knows about what it is, because many people didn't know much about it and how, you know, risky it is and how scary it could be as well. And it was very important because now we don't have at least any negationists. Everyone is agreed that climate change is a problem and it's not an issue. And also we signed a declaration that we are in climate, or organization is under climate emergency.
And are there any kind of big changes that are likely to come up out of the constitution?
Yeah. We have some things already approved. I'll talk about this decentralization, but also we declare the nature rights.
Oh yeah, it's so interesting. I'm aware in Ecuador and Bolivia that nature has legal rights.
Exactly. I think it's very important that we have learned a lot also about other countries. That it's not just the idea to mention, you know, in the paper that okay, nature have rights. Also, how we will apply it in the practice. At the same time, the Committee of Justice is working in environmental justice. And of course, the Committee of Environment is also working the elements of nature, how to protect biodiversity, how to protect water. As for us, it's super important. We also are working to that our constitution is mentioned the human right for water, because we don't have it. there is a place called Petorca here in Valparaíso region, where you found this large plantation of avocados. And next to that, you have people that they don't have water to drink, and they need to receive bottled water, and sometimes water that is not have good quality, and they don't have water for the toilet. So,
am I right to understand that Chile is the only country in the world where the water is private?
No, there are others, but in Chile it's extreme. It's an extreme case.
In what sense?
That the state basically don't have much options to regulate that. So it's a real market for water. So the state cannot go to the avocado plant and say, stop using the water and give it to people. This is impossible because it's private.
And will that change? Is that possible to change?
We first create a new institution that regulates the use of water. You know, the reuse of water that we have in Chile also is not very efficient. So we need to work also on technologies to improve the recycling of water, to have, for example, in the cities, and don't just grass, that just a lot of water, all these kind of things and solutions.
And am I right to understand it's a very inclusive government now? I get the impression it's very inclusive in terms of gender diversity, indigenous representation. Can you maybe speak a bit about that?
First, we decide that the composition of the assembly, we have gender parity. Mm-hmm. So we have 50% women. And that really has an effect. The other day I saw a study that analyzed the speeches and the behavior of the members during the sessions. And women, they speak less than men. Also, because we can donate our minutes to a man or someone else if we want to speak longer. And the women are given the time for men, usually. And also, that's also very cool because about the topics. So men used to talk more about politics system, principles of the constitution, and women are talking more about environment and human rights.
Well, it's not surprising to me because when I researched my book, I looked at the relationship between gender equality and the environment, and there are so many extraordinary statistics. You know, for example, women are more likely to enact environmental legislation if they're in positions of political power. There's a higher concentration of women as members of conservation groups.
Exactly. So as I explained many things, but it's a nice, nice data to see why the thing happens.
So the women need to speak more, maybe.
Maybe. And also we have a representation of indigenous people. That's also have been very, very important because many, for Chile, I think that was a real discovery.
In what sense?
We know that in our country live different nations. So we're still being one nation, Chile, but inside Chile, we are also plurinational. So in the north, we have Aymara, Quechua, Atacameños, Licanantay, like Sonia, mm-hmm. The Aguitas. Here in the center, south, we have Mapuches. Even in the south, we have Yagán, Cahuéscar. And every nation have their own pain, you know, their own suffer. Of course, the happiness as well, but Mapuche people also suffer a lot because they lost their land in a very violent way, and they're still receiving a lot of violence from the state. Chile needs to recognize that also to advance, because some people are still being very racist.
I was told it's almost like a war zone.
Yeah, that's also that they try to do because it's the power there is, again, another extractivist companies that are the forest.
Which kind of companies?
The forestry. They have the land and they destroy the native forest and do plantation of eucalyptus or pina or pines. And yeah, this is a big conflict. And in the north also we have other consequences of Chile, the state, that after the Pacific War that happened in Chile in 1879, the land where I'm from, Antofagasta or Tarapacá, they belong to Peru and Bolivia, and they were included in the Chilean territory. And there were some Chileans as well there, but many, no. We are a society of immigrants in the north. British has a lot of influence, British influence in the last century. Germans, some Croatians, and also Bolivian, Peruvians, Chinese.
Why? Because of the mining?
Because of the mining. So we are multicultural from, you know, always.
And what's been the impact of having that kind of indigenous representation?
The impact is to understand that different way to see the world. At least for me, they're talking about a very nice concept. They have different names depending of the land. It's called the well-being or buen vivir, to live well or well-living. So why we are here, no? To live well, to have good relationship with the rest, to have respect for nature, because nature is essential. It's a mother nature from a Pachamama or the Mapu in the south. And also the relationship between one another is reciprocity, cooperation, solidarity, instead of competition. Of course, they're still being human, and probably not all of them are like that. But when we put in exercise all this interculturality, it's great. In the Constitution, we also have recognized all the indigenous people from Chile, that Chile is a plurinational state, Now we're working to recognize the languages and also their patrimony. One of the things that is already approved that they ask is many of objects, especially, or inclusive people, they are in museums around the world or in collections. So they ask, bring it back to the country. This will be interesting for, for museums.
Yeah, sorry, the British Museum has been quite terrible on this.
I know. Yeah, we are a small country. Maybe not many people know about Chile. It's very, very beautiful. We can learn a lot from here because at some point also we have been a social laboratory. This is a sad part, but we have the hope that things will change and we need to also learn lessons for other countries and think about the future because we are usually thinking about what's happening now, the daily things, and, but we are not thinking about what we have to do now for the future, for the new generations. And something that worries me a lot is the loss of ecosystems and biodiversity. So when we think about all destructivism, it's destruction of nature. So people have to know that everything has a high cost. And it would be nice, for example, that the electric cars come with a sign or something saying there, this lithium that contains these cars come from the Salar de Atacama, and that produce probably the loss of biodiversity. So take care, use well. Don't buy another one, it's not necessary. Because it's not just extraction in the place, also there's transportation in by land or by train locally. Then there is a port or a harbor that put it in a ship going to China. In China they produce the batteries. The battery is exported to Europe. In Europe, assembly in a computer on a laptop. The laptop is buying in a shop. So everything have so many complexities.
I worked in technology for a bit and I found it kind of overwhelming, the complexity of the supply chains and the extraordinary lack of transparency there is in those supply chains. And I think that, you know, it's the growth model that's the that's a big part of the problem. This business model we have of needing to buy and consume more and more and more, and needing to grow GDP of all different sectors, all different industries, regardless of their impact, is kind of an environmental disaster, however we reshape it. Because if you keep needing to buy a new phone every year, or you keep needing to buy a new car every 5 years or so, it's the level of resource extraction is going to cause huge problems, whether it's lithium or oil. So I'm very interested in those kind of deeper economic changes that need to be considered.
Exactly, because the planet has limits. That's also people have to understand. Things will be not forever. And we are really in the border of extinction. Not maybe human extinction, but biodiversity. And that will produce very, very strong consequences, like the pandemics. Because if we think that the planet is a complex of connections, we are missing connections. So it's like we have something very interconnected. Everything has their function, their role. So I always imagine that like a ball of many lights that turn on off. Every time that happens, affecting our planet, all these lights are coming off. And then only few still have contacts. And that's why we have less resilience for changes. So if there is a mutation in a virus, of course we have less genetic pool to act like as a buffer of this mutation and pass directly to human. So that's why we need to not only preserve biodiversity, also preserve the environments and their connections. I really saw that producing the best scientific evidence, of course it's important, but I think will be important for political decisions. So I thought, okay, when we found, for example, that Salares have a very unique biodiversity, I thought, okay, this is enough. No, they will be preserved and we will be part of a protected area. No, nothing is enough until, I think, scientists move to politics. So it's because politicians will not take directly scientific evidence to take decisions, especially in our countries.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was supporting a group in Davos who go every year to the World Economic Forum. They're called Arctic Base Camp, and their whole mission is to bring science to the World Economic Forum because they, you know, feel it's so essential that politicians and CEOs are considering climate science when they make important decisions.
So we propose that in the Constitution, that decision for public policies have to be based on the best scientific evidence. And I was rejected because people really don't understand what is science.
But they didn't accept that the policymakers need to be guided by the best available science.
Not yet. So it was rejected by the first round. So now we have to write it again, maybe have some, you know, political talk with all of them.
That's probably because science doesn't always agree with the economy.
No, I think that hopefully will be some reason like that, because I can understand that you are against that. But I think it was a lack of understanding.
I think this whole kind of growing world of greenwashing with green, you know, politicians greenwashing, businesses greenwashing, even consumers greenwashing themselves. The reality is we can't greenwash science. We can't greenwash physics, you know.
That's a very important point. Because we are scientists, because we love to do science. It's like to be an artist. Yeah, of course, I work in a university, but I'm more than a worker of a university. I'm a scientist. I will be a scientist always because we're passionate about that. When we are connected with our environment, with the people, with our students, we take them to land to show what's going on. It really opens minds, I think, and show us that there is not only way to solve problems. We need to have diversity.
And what does it mean when you say that nature has rights? What does that mean in practice? How will that influence things?
For example, nature can defend from us. So everyone can present a cause regarding that nature has been damaged, because the right of nature is to exist. And if we prove that this process is affecting the whole ecosystem, whatever.
I've heard about that happening in Bolivia, but has it had actual impact on decisions about which industries are allowed to operate where?
The difference with Ecuador and Bolivia, that the Constitution of Ecuador has also beautiful rights, like a very, very big list. But it was not very linked to other organisms of the state to really do what the rights say. So we are thinking in a different way. We thought about that system. So, for example, we changed the name of the justice. Here it was called Poder Judicial, so power. We changed it about justice systems. So we include in, maybe it's not, for many it's not clear or other, but we include in the complexity. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about system, they recognize that also can be indigenous justice. Because they have different codes, you know? And sometimes there are many cases that indigenous people have been judged by Occidental laws, and they are doing their thing that usually do, you know? There are terrible cases showing these injustices, actually, especially against women. So, a lot of work to do.
No, thank you. That was so fascinating. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for speaking.
Sure, no problems. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. As mentioned, this is going to be a two-parter, and so next week we're going to share the second part of this journey into the Atacama Desert. There's a lady called Sonia Ramos, who we mentioned in this episode, who has walked across the desert multiple times to protest against the lithium mining. Incredibly beautiful indigenous woman I spoke with, who took me to see the sacred sites in the Atacama Desert that she's trying to protect. And I share some of the experience I had walking around the lithium mine and speaking with the company who are managing the mine and why they feel like the work they're doing is important. And thank you to impossible.com, the collective that helped fund my trip to the Atacama Desert. So tune in next week and I'll take you on a trip with me into the Atacama Desert. Thank you so much for listening to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. We are so grateful for the guidance and resources from She Changes Climate on this series, an organisation enabling women in all their diversity to lead just climate action globally. and for the music that's been provided by the very wonderful musician, Cosmo Sheldrake. If you like this episode and would like other people to hear it, we'd be so grateful if you would rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts from. And to hear reasons to be optimistic, we have another little Who Cares Wins drop this Friday. This is a Mags Creative production. Catch you next time. Bye.
Go and right to wrong and feed the pelicans.